Welcome to Minority Corner, where we take an introspective look at the world through an intersectional lens. I'm James, he, him. I'm a queer political activist, actor, comedian, self-proclaimed sexy blurred. That's a black nerd. And each week, I'm joined in the corner by other fabulous minorities and some allies tackling the news, pop culture, politics, media, entertainment, and history with a little self-care, self-love sprinkled throughout, all for our own personal and collective empowerment. Hey, Corner Kids, it's a brand new episode of Minority Corner, and it's Pride season, so we had to bring him back, and it is Ben Randall. You know him, you love him, been on the show many a time. I think are one of our political expert correspondents here on the show. You also a theater director based in New York, a Madonna aficionado, and the person that you definitely want on your trivia team, because they'd just be knowing all the history, all the facts, and we jump in to it this week. Questions for Love Island. Why is it so hard to make a queer version? We have an idea, a very simple idea of how you make it happen. And it is the war on critical race theory, because the Republicans just can't handle talking about racism. They just can't handle it. And with our political expert here, we are going to try to solve the crisis at the border. Just kidding. But we are going to debate and respond to Vice President Harris's trip down to Guatemala and her comments and her responses and what's going on down there. And we're going to dive into it. Of course, the issue at the border, it is messy and complicated, mainly because of the shenanigans that the United States has done. But here we are. We're going to dive into it. And then because it is Pride, y'all, we are diving into some queerstery, and we're going to take you into it. Before Stonewall, there were many other uprisings that just did not get the media attention. And mind you, Stonewall barely at the time got the media attention that it did. So we're going to set the table with the Lavender Scare, of why it was so dangerous and damn near illegal to be queer, and then what sprang forth the catalyst of a lot of these uprisings that happened before Stonewall. There were many. And who was at the forefront? Where did they happen? What did they look like? What are the forms that they took place? Again, this will not surprise you. Trans women of color at the forefront of many of them. We're going to go to Philadelphia. We're going to go to Oakland, San Francisco, LA, New York, all over this country. Get ready. Take notes. It is your queerstery happening this Pride. Let's get into it with Ben Randall. Here we are on an all-new Minority Corner. It's time to learn, laugh, and play. Yeah, happy Pride. It must be Pride because Ben Randall is here. Hello, hello.
Happy Pride.
It's nice. We're kind of getting a bit of a Pride this year. I think we're going to... Is it going down in New York? Are we doing it?
No, it's happening. I think some things are still doing virtual, but for the most part, people are here are like, we are ready to mingle. We are ready to be prideful.
Let's bring it all on out. You know, it's interesting. You and I were talking, having an interesting transition coming back into the real world of things. Like it was, there was a simplicity that I do. And again, a lot of people were dying and things like that, of course, and I don't want to like gloss over that. And I'm very fortunate and blessed making it through unscathed, have not lost a family member, but there was this moment that we all were kind of in this together because we didn't know what was happening. And there was also a simplicity that was happening. Again, there was a lot of fear. I didn't know what I was going to do for work, yada, yada. But I couldn't be as busy as I normally was. I had to slow everything down, and now everything seems like it's revving up. And in some ways, I even have not anxiety about Pride, but like, I don't know, I kind of did not mind taking last year off from just like, oh, I'm just going to sit in my home.
No, I know what you mean. And I think on a kind of broader scale, it feels like we have not yet been able to digest what the actual effects of this pandemic are on us as a globe. Like what this will mean for us in kind of real, because it was for many a very long trauma, and like you can't measure trauma that quickly and know how it started to affect you. And that sounds very dramatic, but like I just think it's true. People lost people lost careers, people lost, you know, like livelihoods and I actually remember this is like switching into political gear so soon, but I remember when Biden was first inaugurated, I remember being really moved. He was talking about, at that point back in January, people's, that you were interrupting careers in the, you know, people who are like in their 20s and 30s and even 40s and were interrupting their careers and you're, and that they were being robbed of valuable time to be building that career and building what their life would be. And so you're like, it's not like you're robbing them of hope, but just like you're, that you, we were, that the opportunity cost is truly unknown. There are people, you know, we already know that, you know, 2 million women like are no longer in the workforce. You know, it's a big, you know, this is like getting very quickly into politics, but like,
well, that's what you're here for.
But it's, I feel like even the most emotionally and politically and, you know, for everything, I think the long-term costs, I feel like, are not, we can't quite feel them yet.
And we're not good at dealing with trauma as a nation, right? Like, even what I think when 9/11 happened, it was like, great, who are we going to fucking attack, right? Let's go fucking blow something up or something, right? And so, like, I think it's something that you said is that, like, I feel like there wasn't even time, even as the pandemic was happening, to really, like, even... if you were still working, like, to just pause, all the companies were like, no, how can we keep going? How can we keep going? And we didn't have a government. It was like, no, everyone go home, take care of yourself. We got you and deal. Just survive. That was your only thing. And so I feel like, and now everything is opening up. I know some people who are just like, they're so tired from the pandemic. Like, they're exhausted. And now we got to rev back up. And it's like, but I was just talking to a colleague who, you know, people are like, oh, I'm excited to go out. And she lost a grandparent. And now they're finally, 8 months later, going to go and bury that grandparent. And they are now coming together to grieve, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I've heard that from friends, too, that who were working through the pandemic that were getting completely burned out. And that was the opposite experience for me, unemployed and... having all these, like, you know, prospects being taken off the table and, like, sure, my future becoming more unknown. So it was like, what disruption, but like in completely different ways. And you're right. I think the narrative right now is like, everything's opening. It's amazing. Economy's roaring back. And that's, you're right. America doesn't always deal with trauma well. And so, of course, I think we're immediately kicking into like, good news. And that's true. That's not true. But right. I think it's going to be possible that we like ignore. Well, actually, I feel to a degree we're already seeing that, and like you're hearing about like worker shortages and things like that, and really that's just and some people are, you know, Republicans are blaming it on oh, people don't want to work because of benefits, but at the same time a lot of people actually during the pandemic had a moment to pause in their life and go, do I want to work at that job anymore? Was that a good job?
Right.
And it's like, and actually it could be we don't know yet the economy actually like. Kind of like recalibrating and like businesses may have to adjust and start offering their workers more money or better benefits. To entice more people to get back to work because their jobs suck.
And people have so many opportunities. Like there's, because part of my new job doing diversity, equity, and inclusion is also just the experience of our employees, and people have options. And so what are your companies doing? People want to be able to bring their full selves to work. And I'm grateful to be in a job where it's like, my job is to like, let's create these different, you know, affinity groups and, you know, so people can bring their full authentic selves and don't have to like code switch while they're at work. So a lot of options and things like that. Speaking of options, well, one option that is off the table currently for the LGBTQ community. So there's a hit reality show for mainly just straight people. And it's called Love Island, where it's pretty much a bunch of like sexy, single British people on an island and they're finding love and da da da. And they've been trying to in the UK to make it more inclusive and get LGBTQ folks on it, but they're just like, it just right now there's just a lot of logistical difficulties. And what they mean by that is because usually they'll have like, I think the straight guys and the straight girls are usually in different parts of the, I don't know. I've actually never seen the show, but I have seen reality dating shows. And I imagine that like the guys and the girls are separate. And so I think their thing is like, but if a bunch of gay guys are with each other, they'll just all do each other. It's kind of like why like they struggle with doing a gay bachelor because aren't they all just bachelors? So there's all like what's so special about him? I mean, look at Jerome over here. Like, he looking cute. Like, I don't need Tony. I mean,
there's no way you could just like put 10 guys together and be like,
now don't you do each other.
Well, you're waiting to see if that one's going to marry you. They're going to be like, all right.
But here's my thing, is I think figure it out, then make a new show, create a new formula. When that does work, I think you can actually get a very compelling dating reality show with queer people on it, and it will be actually even more dramatic and more messy as fuck because there's more options. It's not about
Isn't
just like
also
the
though that those are so like I'm sorry to cut you off.
Yeah,
that those are like so straight and so like I'm trying to avoid the word like middle America.
Boring.
I'm trying to avoid that kind of phrase, but boring. Like I kind of feel like it's not a very. I feel like people who watch that those shows like I I'm totally, you know, a snob about rowdy shows. I have to admit.
Sure.
I'm one of those
yes.
people.
So I get it, right. But I think for so long, those of us who are queer and do watch reality television have had to, I'm just so tired of having to watch straight programming anymore. It's like, figure it out. Like, or having to, like, we've had to, like, see ourselves in straight characters and straight reality dating shows for so long. And it's just like, fucking figure it out. And I tell you, it's going to be so interesting because, again, all rules and games are off. Like, someone's seeing somebody, da da da. Like, the drama just really writes itself. And so it's such a missed opportunity. And so I think instead of trying to figure out, like, how do you, I don't know, fit queer people into this peg of this formula of, you know, straight Love Island, like create something completely new.
Yeah.
Like that's figure it out.
Why can't Gay Island just be
hello. Hello. I mean, there it is. Producers were available. That sounds incredibly interesting. Gay Island. Make it happen. All right. Switching gears to something not nearly as fun. So critical race theory is under attack, which I also wasn't sure if that was like a real thing or just something that like that title, you know, like Republicans try to make something like really scary of like, oh, but critical race theory, it's existed since 1989 and it's, you know, pretty much based on research from like the early 60s to the early 70s and essentially just kind of looking at, you know, race is a real thing that has been designed as a system, a caste system here in the United States. And it's a exploration of what that is and what that looks like. And of course, Republicans just can't have any of that, especially like white people get so for like clutching their pearls when we ask to look at some of the terrible things that this country has done towards other people. And doesn't make you anti-American, as they say. So Brian Kemp tweeted, I guess he wrote a letter to the Georgia State Board of Education calling critical race theory divisive and that it had an anti-American agenda. And the board voted 11-2 to pass a resolution that denounced critical race theory and declared it that, you know, the United States of America is not a racist country and that the state of Georgia is not a racist state. I couldn't finish reading that sentence without laughing.
Yeah, but actually, okay, let me say something like slightly, just so we're not like in vigorous agreement, slightly controversial. I always want to move as quickly as possible off of the point of America is a racist country, because I think it plays into this longstanding struggle that we've had on this issue with white people for decades now, and that they can safely say, I don't think this is a racist country, and then you can say, I think it's a racist country, and you both can be correct.
Mm-hmm.
Not just because the facts, not because I'm saying that the facts are disputed, no, but that we get into like what the perception of racism is.
Sure, yeah.
Not even the definition of it, but what we've been taught racism is, and I think like boomers have been taught that like when they were growing up, it was like the civil rights
people
going
in
on.
Sheets with burning
exactly
crosses
right.
And things like that.
And they were taught racism is bad, and if you were, and they, those are bad people, and so they grew up thinking, well, if I'm a good person, I can't be racist,
right?
As opposed to learning it was like actions and thoughts and like, you know, things that like you can't avoid, and like this concept of what's in your heart and is America really a racist country is like
right.
such a distraction.
Yes, which is why I'm really loving Isabel Wilkerson's book, Caste, which is really painting the picture of like, okay, let's reframe it as America has a caste system, right? Because that is undisputable. Then you can start seeing, and then it's not necessarily like, then we're looking at the systems, because it's really just looking at the systems in place that, you know, do put different people at different rankings based on, you know, their race. But I think the whole entire just like part of like what Georgia is saying essentially, like, is in their retort against it, a lot of it was like, I'm not going to read their full entire thing. Like, they pretty much were just like, we don't want our young white students to feel bad because they're white. Like, that was pretty much like the gist of it. They were just like, nothing can be taught that might make a white person feel guilty. That was the gist of it. Like, that's what I just, and then they said, yeah, I just like, it's so frustrating for me because then once people learn the realities of things, then we can like maybe move some of these statues into museums or things like that. Like they don't need to be able to put up some better statues of people that actually really do represent what we think America, you know, is in this place of like freedom. There's people that we can all actually probably, you know, agree on and find ourselves on. And then like, oh, they said that, you know, there's no teaching that they teach that slavery was a deviation from American founding principles. But I mean, that kind of ignores the Three-Fifths Compromise, which was like written into the Constitution. So like, no, absolutely not. So it's gaslighting. It's infuriating. And then, you know, Georgia, like if you don't want to be a racist place then, or be classified as such, then don't have like your voter suppression laws that are still cooking up, right? That are still oppressing certain groups of people, because that is, you're actually like, if it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, that duck is racist. Like, that's when the racist duck.
Yeah, and this is just because this is what the Republicans have to run on. This is the new Republican Party. It's about identity, and so if they can be bringing up critical race theory at every turn and reminding white voters that they are the party of white people. That is truly what it is.
It's so exhausting because they coined the term identity politics, and they like at every turn you would just assume that they are the most, like, if I was an alien coming to this planet, I would think like, oh my God, the poor white people are the most disenfranchised like group. Like everyone is just trying to silence them. And little did I know they have like all the power and all the control. Yes. And they cry it the most. And it's yes, this is gaslighting. Is because I feel like I'm on fire right now. Is that gaslighting is? Because I want to I wasn't angry before. Now I'm angry just talking about this.
I actually don't think I understand the full like the actual reason for that metaphor about gaslighting. Is it because like a gas flame, the fire flows through it, and it can like blow like a blowtorch? Is that
I always imagined it.
You can project
was like
the fire.
I imagine gaslighting is like you lighting yourself on fire because you're so like you're getting so hot. Minority Corner listeners tweet at us because like we don't know. There's an answer to this.
We could just Wikipedia it, but like we understand the concept, but where does it come from?
I feel like I always thought gaslighting was like I'm being gaslit, which is like I'm like being lit on fire because of like you're like, oh, but that's not really a table. You're like, no, this is a fucking table. This is a table. You're like, no, I don't think that's a table. And it legit is a table.
You're causing a lot of ruckus about this table.
And it's like, but we can't even agree that it's not a table. And so that, to me, was always my idea of gaslighting. But I want to switch from one tricky subject to a different subject. Because originally I was like, Ben Randall, you have to come on and we have to talk about Palestine. And you were like, what? Like, as if you were this expert on Palestine. I was like, who do I know? Ben, please come on the show and please explain
that
Palestine.
Ain't me.
And so we're not going to talk about that, actually. Instead, we're going to talk about immigration. So it's maybe a little bit, it's still complicated.
It's insanely
but a little
complicated.
Bit easier. It's insanely complicated. But I think, at least for myself, I feel a little bit slightly more confident to talk about immigration than I do. Because it's so far away. I think there's a physical connection. At least like we're on the same physical continent. It's a little bit more in my face a little bit. I don't know. I feel a little bit more confident in talking about it than Israel-Palestine.
Well, because one half of this is going to be Americans that we're talking about. We're not talking about two different groups that are not us.
Okay. Yes. Absolutely. That's the other thing. I'm like, this is really, I'm not also not like, I don't, as far as I know, I just took my, I did just take a DNA test to find out if I'm 100% that bitch, and we're still waiting on the results. So we'll find out if I have any connection to Israel-Palestine. But as far as I know, I don't. And so I also don't even necessarily like, I have a humanitarian, like, us is all human skin in the game, but not directly. And so for myself, I'm just the intern here just to, like, listen and support and collect information at that point. Like, and I just, you know, you leave it for me. I'm like, let me leave it to the smarter people to discuss. But we're going to talk about immigration because something happened recently with Vice President Harris. Do you want to walk through the kids through what's the kerfuffle that's happening?
Vice President Kamala Harris is making her first foreign trip to the Northern Triangle. She's going to Guatemala and Mexico City, and she has been tasked with working on the root causes to migration across the southern border. Mm. Essentially, immigration across the southern border. And she, while in Guatemala, was getting heat from both the left and the right. From the right, really basically through the press, who didn't want to talk about anything but the right-wing talking points of why aren't you actually at the border and not in Guatemala. And, of course, her response was, because I'm in Guatemala, I'm trying to deal with the root causes of migration. Yes. And so you're going to go to the border. And she was like, I've been to the border. I'll be back to the border. Right now I'm in Guatemala.
I mean, they always find something, like, when it was Memorial, it was, I think it was the Friday of Memorial Day weekend, and she's like, have a nice long weekend. Oh, yes. And everybody from Meghan McCain to everybody was like, people died, da-da-da. Mind you, Memorial Day is not until fucking Monday, and I'm correct. Sure she had and a Friday, tweet ready to go, weekend. And people were outraged. It's because there is no real controversies, and they're trying to, like, you know...
Well, yes. And, well, in this one, I'm really excited to get into this issue because this, to me, I have a larger thing that's a lot bigger than me, you know, in any way defending Justice Administration by any way, but more just like my kind of hotter take on the broader take on it all. And then from the left, she got in some heat when she was giving her first prepared speech in Guatemala. And it was a 40-minute speech, but there's this 1 9-second clip that was the one that everyone carried.
Which is always what happens. You can have a long speech and people are like, oh, but what did they say here?
and she says in that 9 seconds, if you are thinking about coming to America, do not come. Please do not come. And everyone from AOC to even groups that principal groups like ACLU and things like that came out and were correctly noting that to seek asylum is a legal international right. Mm-hmm. And then there's also then this like next wave of people wanting to discuss America's very real impact on Central and Latin America. And so let's just dive in from there because I don't want to hog all this because I have lots of things to say, but I want to.
And I think that was the point that I thought was really is I think it's. It's challenging in a lot of ways, like, because again, if I just read the snippet, like, don't come here, I do see on two folds of one, I do understand the point, like, the border is a mess, and they had inherited a mess, it just has been a mess for a very long time, so on one end, it's like, don't come here, because it's like, this house is like, you know, not ready, it's also very dangerous, but on the other end, people's countries are so fucked up, that it's also, I mean, it is a Hail Mary, like, pass, like, where it's also not safe for me to stay here. And why is it not safe for me to stay here? Because America done fucked it up back in the 70s, the 50s, Eisenhower, like, every single one of these countries that people are fleeing, the United States has had a hand in toppling that government, putting somebody else in. And I think it is something that I think for some people, what is missing from that, and I will admit, I did not watch the full 40-minute speech, so maybe she did touch on this, but I think it's the acknowledgement of what we have done. And I think this is our reckoning. I've said that this is going to be the reckoning 20s, you know, not the roaring 20s. It's going to be the reckoning 20s. And I think what people are asking for is accountability and coming to terms. We're having a racial reckoning, right? And so, you know, when you have Biden to be the first president to acknowledge the massacre of Black Wall Street, the first president, right? Because people are asking for it. We're saying, let's look at this. Let's talk about this. This happened. And so I think like what's missing from for some people in some of these conversations is that acknowledgement of like, now we know that it's messed up because of what we did. I think adding in that little part of it is missing for some people. And it's tricky because you're in a country and you're trying to not appease both sides, but it is 365 million people who want different things. And but even just from a humanitarian sense of just, I think, and again, I didn't watch the full 40-minute video, so maybe you have some insights. I think making sure that compassion and humanity is still there of like, we know that you're fleeing from things that were not your fault and caused by our very country, but we're working to change that. And is there a plan for us to also work within those countries to help? I don't know. That's going to make
that's
it worse.
That's what she's doing.
Okay.
This is my like, that's my like, oh my God, that's my whole like, I'm so, this is my little soapbox on this, is that I'm so like incensed that what's getting press is this dumb 9-second clip. And what's not getting press is that she's in Guatemala and Mexico City because she's trying to work with those countries to try to improve the conditions in those countries so that people will not need to flee. That was not just the entirety of this trip. It's what she's been working on. She's been working with tech companies and American corporations. And they have, I think so far she's lined up 130 million, not that much, of investment in the region. Because the problem is with all these, it's really complicated because these different countries have different pressures. Right. Some, it's like, and a lot of these pressures are going to get worse, whether it be like climate change and hurricanes and extreme poverty.
Let alone the pandemic.
The pandemic. Of course, of course, there's violence. Of course, there's corruption. Each country has a different set of conditions that's leading to the root causes of the migration.
Yeah.
And so it's not a one size fits all. And this is where what gets tricky about this is that her aim, what she's been tasked to do, is try to address the root causes that she will not fix in 4 years.
Right.
Because everything you mentioned about the U.S.'s influence on that region was happening starting with Eisenhower.
This
goes back decades. Also, it should be noted, Bill Clinton apologized to Guatemala in 1999. So it's like the reckoning already happened. Okay. Like that already, a president has already apologized formally, which is like actually a big deal. Like that's like the biggest thing America can do for you is like, not that can do for you, but more like the most formal apology.
I think it's the first thing that we can do. And then there's got to be the reparations that happens after that. Like apology is great. Yeah. But then also too, like, sorry, fuck things up. Anyways, next order of business. Like, I think the building, and in some ways I'm like, we should maybe stay out of this. But actually, I think it's part of making amends. I think it is like Make America Make Amends tour around. Because you do have like the coups in Argentina, Chile, like Guatemala. Like, it makes my stomach hurt so much of the pain that this nation has caused, not only to its own citizens who are of like non-white or who maybe were even Irish but eventually became white. So like what caused a lot of pain.
What does that look like though? Because does it look like exactly what she's doing and which no one even knows about that she's doing? Because we're only because I actually like got really incensed when I saw AOC's tweet, because she was like, one, seeking amnesty is international is a legal right. Two, this is because the U.S. did blah 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 in the region. And she implied that something like, and you need to do something for them. And I was like,
well, what she did say is we can't help set someone's house on fire and then blame them for fleeing.
No, I thought it was stupid because you know what was stupid? I thought it was like the most ignorant thing she could have said, because I went, wait, Kamala and the Biden administration are not blaming Guatemalans for them leaving. And just because they're not saying we are the reason why you are in this position. All she's saying is, what she actually said in that speech was, most people do not want to leave their homes. It comes at great expense, at great fear, great risk. You don't want to leave. The whole point about addressing the root causes is trying to help people there so they don't need to flee. Mm-hmm. Because the fact of the matter is, with this amnesty thing, is most of these people aren't eligible for amnesty. Mm-hmm. Extreme poverty isn't going to get you amnesty. Mm-hmm. It's just going to get you turned away at the border. And so you will have spent $15,000, probably hired a coyote, you know, put your lives in jeopardy, your kids' lives in jeopardy, you know, facing, you know, rape, death, all of these horrible things to make this 3,000 mile trek and then get turned away. Yeah. So it's like, I don't think it's actually of, I think my larger point here is this is a very complicated issue, and I must say it makes my heart sink to see both the extreme right flank and then the progressive flank of the country being really simplistic about it, and the right is just going, lock it down, they're all criminals, we don't owe them anything. And then I feel like sometimes the progressive flank is so focused on what we did, and therefore I'm often like, well, yeah, but the law is still the law, and unless you're getting Joe Manchin to change that law, then embassy is only going to cover this little sliver. And so like, I agree with you that I'd love to reform this whole system, but like, we need to get something done here. Mm-hmm. And if Kamala going down to the region and saying, this is not safe, don't come, is way off the mark for you, and you're not going to pay attention to anything else she's doing, well then like, we're not going to get anywhere, people. Like, that's my biggest, like, we got to start looking at the complexity and the whole thing.
And the whole speech. I mean, it's a bad soundbite. And so I think everyone needs to do their due diligence. I will say that I am not of, you know, immigrant experience kidnapped lineage, and forced to work. So that's, you know, my thing. So, but I can't, for somehow triggering this is, and to see a comment like that. And so I think it is so complicated that I think it's just, I hope that this administration just gets that story out a little, like, more. And maybe they are, like, be on the Sunday shows and telling the story more of, like, what it is that they're doing. I will say, in general, Democrats have a terrible PR team and don't really tell the stories of the things that it is that they're doing. Because everything you just said, that sounds really interesting. I'd heard little snippets of what she was trying to do down there, but that was the most succinct plan and plan that really speaks to, like, the future, like working with tech companies, and every country is different. So I think can they maybe fold in a little bit of like our history, as like, you know, in the speeches, it's like, you know, this happened, the United States did this in Argentina in, you know, 1976, and we're here working with Argentina to do ba da ba da ba. I think folding in, people also need to learn their history a little bit. And so I think there's just a way to do both. All right, coming up next, it is Pride, and we are going to go into the history of the queer community that I feel like you just don't know. Before Stonewall Uprising was not the first. There were many to come before. Right after this break. It's spring, or wait, no, actually it's summer, even better. So it is time to change up the house, put those winter sheets and things away, and time to treat yourself and upgrade your home for something a little bit more comfortable and a better look. It's time for Brook Linen. So Brook Linen was started to create beautiful, high-quality home essentials that don't cost an arm and a leg, which I love. And what's really dope about Brook Linen, they work directly with manufacturers to make luxury available directly to you without those crazy prices, because you know they'd be trying to charge so much. And you get an amazing array of products at a reasonable price. I've said this so much, but I love my Brook Linen sheets. I love them. I sleep so comfortably in them, and they make me feel fancy. And I think everyone deserves to feel like the fancy royal highness that they are. Yes, Your Eminence, go get you some Brook Linen sheets. And they have something, they don't have just sheets, they have all kinds of different products. You can go over and check out what they got, because they got something for you, all different kinds of colors and patterns and products. It is time to summer spruce it up. I don't know if that's a thing, but it is now. So give yourself the comfortable refresh that you deserve and get it less at Brook Linen. Go to brooklinen.com and use promo code MINORITY to get $20 off with a minimum purchase of $100. That is brooklinen.com and enter promo code MINORITY for $20 off with a minimum purchase of $100. Once again, that's brooklinen.com, promo code MINORITY.
From the internationally acclaimed creators of Who Shot Ya comes the movie podcast Maximum Film, starring producer and film festival programmer Drea Clark as a woman bound by passion.
I saw this 8 months ago on the festival circuit, and I loved it.
Film critic Alonzo Duralde as a man corrupted by greed.
Why watch one Hallmark Christmas movie when I can watch seven?
And comedian Ify Wadiwe as a man protecting a love that society simply won't accept.
I think Pacific Rim is a perfect movie. And if you can't accept that, then I want you out of my life.
From the makers of the movie podcast, Who Shot Ya, comes Maximum Film.
That's right. We changed the name of our show to Maximum Film.
But don't worry. We're still a movie review show that isn't just a bunch of straight white dudes.
So tune in to Maximum Film at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
It is Pride time, and we're gonna do some Pride history for you folks. So before we do that, I want you to set the table and set the scene. So before, we're not going to talk about Stonewall today. If you don't know what the Stonewall uprisings are, I doubt that, because you're listening to this podcast. And so I think that you have a clue. And if you don't, you can go into the catacombs of Minority Corner. There's an episode early on, episode 4, I think it was. We talk about it. So we're going to talk about, there was, for whatever reason, the earlier ones, I got them locked in. But once we get past 10, I'm like, I don't know. Episode 50 was the episode that we talked about why your camera is racist.
4, you remember
just
it.
Certain numbers just stick into my mind. Yeah. 306 episodes. Here we go. All right. So in the 1950s, I do recommend this documentary series. It's on FX Hulu called Pride. And it talks about how, like, prior to the 1950s, there were surprise, queer people just living, sometimes just doing their own thing. They would be with their partners. Not to say that there wasn't a stigma, but the stigma did not really kick into gear until McCarthyism with the Lavender Scare. Because before, you maybe had stigma from like a religious stance, because that was there. Because again, you had queerness happening all across the globe until Christianity and the Muslim traditions came in and was like, you stop doing that, you stop doing that. And so they were able to, through the Lavender Scare, to be able to link being gay to communism, ooh, which was like the scariest thing of the time, communism. And I look back and I'm like, what were y'all so afraid of? What were you so afraid of? I don't understand. They were so afraid of communism. And in 1953, President Dwight D. Eisenhower, Executive Order 10450, what is that, 10450? I don't know what the kids call it. And that is the investigation, interrogation, and systemic removal of gay men and lesbians from federal government. That became policy. And because we pose a threat to the national security, because apparently we were vulnerable to blackmail and were considered to have weak moral characters. And so you have this thing about, so we were lumped into the Red Scare. So there's a documentary called The Lavender Scare. We became a scapegoat, essentially. And this is why this is so interesting, because once, like, it really matters what the government says. When the government says who can have those jobs, then the rest of the, like, private sector, they're like, well, nope, the government is not allowing that. We're not either. And so essentially this is why, queer people could be fired for being homosexual. They could, not get, apartments, all these things, which we were essentially being erased out of our own country. And so that's why it matters when, Trump's ban was very similar to the Lavender Scare, saying that trans folks couldn't serve into the military, because that gave other businesses, the credence to be able to say, no, the government is saying this. So just sort of it's a slippery slope. And folks would be interrogated about their personal lives, questions like, oh, have you ever had, like, same-sex relationships? All this sort of business that is ain't nobody's business. And it's estimated somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 people probably lost their government jobs during this time. And so it would then span to Hollywood and, bars, nightclubs, the workforce. It just, kept spreading. And it wasn't until 1995 President Bill Clinton signed an executive order banning discrimination based on sexual orientation, and the granting of security clearances. And in 1998, that discrimination was banned in government employment. 1998, we were alive. 98. So that's sort of setting the table of what you had. Like, people were, kind of doing their own thing. And then I think this is why you start to see this rise in anti- gayness happens during the 50s, during this whole entire Lavender Scare bit. And it was also, too, it was illegal for gay folks to even be served alcohol, which that always just gets me because, like, we needed a drink at this time. Like, it is already stressful enough. We can't get a drink. And you had, like, that's why the mafia had stepped up. And so when you have, like, bars like Stonewall, they were owned and operated by the mafia. And not because they liked gays. They liked money. They liked money.
Money. So you could bribe them to protect you from
100%. Absolutely. So I don't want to just, like, you know, this is not a parade for the mafia. Like, ooh, there are allies. I was like, no, they like money. And two, you have the civil rights movement really start to, you know, kicking up right in the 60s. And I want to give snaps and shout outs to Bayard Rustin, who organizes the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Black, gay man, brilliant. And, you know, he essentially organized this huge thing. And that was a huge catalyst for what the civil rights movement could do. So all these other movements are really taking notes off of this. And while you don't, Bayard had to take a back seat because government's coming in and they're like, oh, you know, he's immoral, and kind of making him front and center. And so when you have Martin, and like, he's the one that taught Martin Luther King Jr. all about, you know, nonviolence, because Bayard had gone to India and studied it over there. And so he had this huge impact, organized this huge, I mean, leave it to a gay person to plan like the biggest party. The biggest protest party of the time. And this was also an opportunity, like the Southern Christian leadership saw it as a way to push Bayard out. And it's unfortunate because who knows what could have happened from his brilliant mind and voice. So, so that's all in the heels. So you have people now, you know, we were pushed into, you know, it's pretty much illegal to be queer on any aspect, but then you have in the 60s people are starting to use their voices a little bit more, right? So our first place, that was the table's set, now let's eat. Okay. I want to take us to, and I'm curious of how many of these that you will know of Ben Randall. So this is also a test, so I want you to, because you're a history buff and you know your stuff. So the first one, we're going to go to Tappan 10 years prior to Stonewall in 1959. So even before Bayard was doing his thing. So the Cooper Donuts riot in Los Angeles, May of 1959. Okay, so police had showed up and tried to round up the gay men and trans women and hustlers and drag queens who frequented the late night LA coffee shop. And two, to put a pivot in a little a pin in this, is that, like, because a lot of, you know, gay and trans and queer people couldn't get any other jobs sometimes aside from being hustlers or things like that, or like late night performers. So these were like some of their, because they just weren't gonna get hired, and folks gotta eat. So, you know, and again, what a travesty, a country just failing its own citizens and people. And so officers entered into Cooper's Donuts. They were demanding identification. And if a customer's gender presentation didn't match what was on their ID, they'd then be taken to jail. And so they had tried to arrest a bunch of the folks who were there, including author John Recchi. John, good old John. So John recounted the incident in City of Night, which I guess is one of his works. And so here's what happened. Onlookers threw coffee and donuts and trash at the cops, and the cops left empty-handed because they were just putting up too much of a fight. And then as the riot uprising, as I will say, spread into the streets, then police blocked off Main Street, and then they started to arrest some of the protesters. But this is considered the first LGBTQ uprising in the United States.
I think I maybe had heard about it and just forgotten about that, because I feel like there's something about the donuts and the coffee that was like, I think I have heard about this.
Yeah, wait a minute. The donuts and the coffee. Yeah, not today. Yeah. Okay. So number two, picket at Whitehall Street Induction Center. This happened in New York, September 19, 1964. This was believed to be the first organized demonstration for gay rights. The other one was not. They did not intend to, but this one was like, okay, we're going to do this. So this is 1964. Protesters picketed outside the U.S. Army building at 39 Whitehall Street in downtown New York, which had been an armed forces examination and entrance station since 1886. And this group was led by Randy Wicker and members of the Sexual Freedom League. I did not know about them, who demonstrated against the military's discriminatory policies and the outing of homosexual men rejected for service, because folks were being discharged left and right, honestly, since like World War One and Two, which is why you get such, no, World War Two specifically, that's why you get so many gay men who end up in San Francisco, because they've been discharged for being gay, and then they're there in San Francisco, and they're like, I'm not going back home because I'm going to stay here, because where else am I going to go? So that's how you start getting San Francisco to be this absolutely gay mecca. Mm-hmm.
All those sailors.
So all those sailors. And so it would be, and also who were serving their motherfucking country. So calm down, everybody. So it'd be 47 years before the U.S. government lifted the ban on gays and lesbians in the military in 2011. So they were out there picketing back in the 60s and not until 2011. So this one was interesting because it just goes to the sadistic nature of people who are afraid and on the right. So this was Council on Religion and Homosexual Ball. So in January 1st, 1965, there was this dialogue that used to happen. This was established a year prior in 1964. There was a dialogue between clergy and gays. It was the Council on Religion and the Homosexual. You know what? The Council on Religion and the Homosexual? It's called the Homosexual. I guess it was just the one.
I lied. It was me.
They had a meeting with Ben Randall. He would go and talk about him. Ben, this
good work.
This would have been so they had a lavish drag ball over at the San Francisco's, over at City Hall on New Year's Day, 1965. And so this was like a working dialogue, which I think is fabulous, right? Gays and clergy talking it out. But they had worked to really follow the
minister. Did someone invite the Pope?
Well, what happened was... I guess maybe that he got bitter that he wasn't invited. They didn't invite the Pope, but the Popo did come. So they had worked diligently to follow all the municipal codes and even told the police, hey, this party's going to be happening. And the police were dissuaded from pressuring the hall to cancel the party, but they showed up with lights and cameras and photos and were just snapping of the clergymen and their wives. And so the newspapers just had like a field day with this. And officers had repeatedly entered the venue under the guise of like making an inspection, which that's suspect. And that used to happen a lot. They'd be like in plain clothes of like, oh, I'm just going into this gay bar to just see what's going on. Or like, oh, I'm gonna cruise these parks and like, I'm gonna suck his dick. I'm undercover though. Like, well, how did you know he was gay until you were having sex with him? So there's, I think, some self-hatred happening up in here too. And they eventually challenged the police intrusion because it was a private event. But the attorneys, were then arrested as well. And then the next morning, the clergy leaders held a press conference that were like, hey, the police are harassing, you know, gay people. And then the public action inspired San Francisco's gay rights movement. And the incident at California Hall is often described as San Francisco's Stonewall. Okay, Dewey's lunch counter sit-in. This happened in Philadelphia, April 25th, 1965. So Dewey's was a chain of hamburger joints in Philadelphia. And after a encounter with some rowdy, quote unquote, they were classified as rowdy, gender nonconforming teens, the employees began refusing service to any customer they believed to be gay or otherwise challenge gender norms. So 1965, that's the scene. And so on April 25th, 1965, 150 people were refused service there. They were like, okay, we got you. And they were working in conjunction with local gay rights group called the Janus Society. I feel like there's all these groups I had no idea even existed, you know? our history just erased. So three teenagers walked into Dewey's that day and they staged a sit-in, and the demonstrators at the Janus Society, President Clark Pollack, he came down to help, and then he also was arrested. And Pollack, he said, you know, this was that the protest was a result of Dewey's refusal to serve a large number of homosexual folks who are wearing non-conformist clothing. Like, what the fuck is the big deal, right? What is the big deal? It's also a lot, like, fighting, there's a lot of stress and pressure for this business. Like, why are you letting this anxiety into your life? Like, just let people be people. Let them just live. It's, you know. And then in the wake of the arrest, the Janus Society, they picketed Dewey's, and they distributed about 1,500 leaflets. So this is like pre-Twitter. You got to have a pamphlet, got to get leaflets out there. That's how you get your voice out there. Could you imagine? You'd have to, like, back in the day, Ben, be like, we got to get these pamphlets made. I could see you having some cute pamphlets. Hey, I got a Twitter account, but I got a printing press. And then a week after the initial demonstration, another smaller sit-in took place and the police arrived, but this time there were no arrests. And then Dewey stopped denying service to people who appeared homosexual. So they won. You know, they were like, okay, this is too much work. And they said that we could stay there as long as they wanted, as the police had no authority to ask them to leave. So that was like one of the first sit-ins of its kind. Okay, this one I know that you know. Compton's Cafeteria, right in San Francisco. Okay. Did you want to take us through this one, or you want me to do? What do you know about Compton's, Ben Randall? What do you know?
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, Compton's Cafeteria was located in the Tenderloin district of San Francisco. Which I love today is now the first, I'm paraphrasing the official title of this, is the first transgender historical neighborhood. I'm trying to remember. It's being designated an official, like the 2-3 block radius has been designated the transgender historical. I feel so terrible that I'm like butchering this because I don't have the notes in front of me for that. But it was in this area that there was a Compton's Cafeteria, and this was a late night, a diner, if you will, that would frequently kind of be the home to many young, usually teenagers, who had been maybe perhaps like pushed out of their homes, run away from home, many gender nonconforming. At the time, they often would do, some would do sex work, not all of them would. And they would often meet there. Because, of course, this is pre-cell phones. They can't be like, hey, what's up, sis? Yeah. So they had to go get a cup of coffee or just go sit in a diner stall and wait and see who came by. And then they'd be, you know, be comparing notes. They would be comparing, like, how'd your night go? How's this going? Whatever, to catching up and such. And they would frequent Gene Compton's Cafeteria. And in 1966, there was one night when the police, who would give these teens a hard time periodically through the area. If you think about this, it's really quite awful when you think about these teens who had, I'm not going to say nowhere to go, but nowhere to go, you know, and who are just trying to find community and trying to find, you know, their chosen family. And they would be harassed on the streets. There were even laws that about like blocking the sidewalks
with a ridiculous rule. What's the harm? Like, what is the harm? And that's the thing, is that, like, what is the role of government, really? Right? Isn't it you be here to, like, help people and make sure people are safe? Like, what is the, like, I said this to you before, like, the two oldest professions are storytelling and, like, sex work. Like, those are, like, two of the oldest professions. They're always going to be here, so let's create space for them. And to be honest, like, I want your tax dollars. I think everyone should pay taxes. Jeff Bezos pay taxes. We need new schools, new roads. Let's get that money flowing into the city. We're missing out.
And it was also because the 60s had, like, a rising visibility for reaching out and helping these groups, these communities, I should say, you know, like Glad Memorial Church was actually founded during this time, and they were reaching out or I'm not sure if they found it at this time, but they began reaching out to the transgender community. So with this kind of like increased visibility, the police started actually like, you know, this counter movement, as always happens in with humans. The police were countering this with like beginning to harass and like, you know, crack down on transgender people just existing in the Tenderloin district. District, that's the word. It's a historical district, not neighborhood.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
I think it's titled this Transgender Historical District, I think.
Okay, I got you.
It's wonderful. It's amazing. And I'm so happy that people worked so hard to get that passed. And and I was about to attribute to people, I'm pretty sure, who did, like, the amazing Honey Mahogany. But I don't want to, like, attribute to, like, not have the official names in front of me, because I'm sure people worked very hard. Fair. And I want to give all.
But I'm sure she was involved.
Oh yeah, and deserves
stats,
credit.
Yes,
I just
want to
make sure I'm not naming people.
Also, Honey Mahogany, come on the show. Oh my God. Just not get my Facebook message. I'm just gonna have
you. Already legendary. So there was one night where the police were they were harassing a transgender woman, she resisted arrest by throwing a cup of coffee in the police officer's face. And it was followed by the rest of the clientele, but many of the other transgender women and teens started also throwing back and throwing their high heels and their bags and throwing whatever they had on them at the cops. Now, sadly, eventually, like the Gene Compton's cafeteria actually banned, just like, you know, Dewey's banned the clientele from coming back. And so that's, you know, the sad part of the story. But it did begin to coal in the fire on this. But sadly, there was only one story in the San Francisco Chronicle buried deep in it. It was virtually unreported. It's really kind of remarkable that, like, actually the emergence of Compton's Cafeteria Riot as a pivotal moment in queer history, like, truly did not come about until, like, the past, like, 10 years or so. And I feel terrible for not also having this in front of me, because it was a very specific documentarian who uncovered this and then found all these survivors, and the stories started coming out of it, because it was not nationally reported on.
Yes.
And that's why Stonewall became what Stonewall was because it was getting, it got national press.
And that's the thing, is you've got to put eyes on it. The murder of George Floyd had eyes on it. And I just think that all of these stories that happened, I just keep thinking, like, man, if these queens had had cell phones back then, you know, it would have been caught on tape. People couldn't see how they were being treated. And it that's why, like, Stonewall was the biggest one, like you said, so it had that, like, you know, media attention to it. I do actually want to just with Dewey's stop denying service to people who appeared homosexual. So in Dewey's case, like, they did not revert back. Like, they actually like won. But yeah, good old Compton's right in here in our backyard here. Another couple, if we will. It's important to hear our history. So you know what? We're gonna take the time because I can honestly say I didn't know a single one of these queer stories. I did not. I had no idea. So this one is the Julius's Sippin in New York City, and. Yeah, April 21st, 1966. So, again, in New York State, the Liquor Authority had barred establishments from serving booze to gays, and which we needed our drinks, but they wouldn't get us. And that's stupid, because you're missing out on money, because we like to drink.
Exactly.
Stupid. Mafia.
We didn't go have kids. Like,
yes, we're missing out all this disposable income, y'all. And so members of the Mattachine Society, so if you don't know about them, Google it. But they took a page from the Civil Rights Movement. And New Conservatory Theater did a show about the Mattachine Society, and that's how I learned from them. How would you describe the Mattachine Society? They were like an activist group org of homosexual men.
Yes, they were formed by
men.
Harry Hay in 1948, and in Los Angeles, actually. But there went on to be different units, like one in New York and one, I think, in Chicago. And they were, it was designed actually around trying to, it was kind of a radical almost notion of viewing, if that, as they viewed it, gay history, primarily, and I think in their eyes, I think it was strictly gay men, as uplifting their history and their community the way the civil rights movements had with the Black community or with with Jewish populations and communities and immigrants, and trying to assimilate them into the culture to stop the oppression. In a real kind of way that now feels like kind of obvious, but at the time it was kind of almost revolutionary in that respect, because it was so trying to transform opinions, not just like seek protection from police or stop violence and harassment and things. It was actually designed that it was actually largely formed by a bunch of wealthy gay men.
That's right.
So they were trying to use their status to try to be like, why? What if we tried to start organizing?
I mean, you can tell from that Mattachine Society, like where you're at, like, you know, from right there. It's not no ACT UP. It's like, you know, Mattachine Society. So they were you said they were inspired by the civil rights movement. And I, you know, they went to Julius's because they knew that Julius's wasn't going to serve homosexuals. And so there was a lot of like uniformed cops who'd be stationed outside there. And so one of the guys said that, you know, we knew that we wouldn't be served there. So when we walked in, the bartender put glasses in front of us and they were like, we're gay and we intend to remain orderly. We just want to be served. And then the bartender would be like, well, hey, if you're gay, I can't serve you. And then he would put his hands over the top of the glass, right? And so there was this whole entire thing that they would do. And so they did this sort of song and dance number. Essentially, what they would do is they got a bunch of the reporters to show up there, and it would like tip the cat. They would like let the reporters know that like that this is what was going on. It was able to catch attention to the let's see, who was it? Yeah, so with the help of the ACLU, the Mattachine Society ended up filing a discrimination charges because the New York Times had run the headline, "Three deviates invite exclusion by bars." Extra, extra.
Deviants.
Deviites? Yeah, Deviites. It was in, it was covered in the Village Voice and the New York Times. So,
wait, Deviites? There's no N? They didn't call them Deviants?
No, according to this article, Deviites.
Deviites?
Sounds like my new pop group, Three Deviites. Yeah.
Oh my God, the Deviites.
The Deviites.
It's like a K-pop group.
It is. So yeah, so they it was like pretty much it was a very organized like sip in because they like made sure the reporters were there, and then he was like very loudly, "Well, if you're gay, I can't serve you. Hand over top of glass." Like, of course, leave it to the
white gay protest.
Leave it to the Mattachine Society to like do a full like theatrical production of a sip in. Right. So anyways, they were able with the ACLU to form a charges alongside with but their human rights, you know, the whole thing ended up in court. And the, you know, Constitution says that people have the right to peacefully assemble and nothing's more peaceful than a sip-in, and that the state can't take that right away from you. And so the liquor authority can't prevent gay people from congregating in bars. And they just, you know, took everything I guess they won. They also won their court case. So go off, Mattachine Society. Okay, I just have two more here. They're juicy ones. I originally was like, I'll just do five, but they were so good. So there's only two that we're not going to do. And you can look at the article. So you have homework, listeners. There was one that it was like their goal. I forget what society it was, but they were like, the lesbians had to dress in like skirts and the men had to wear suits. They were trying to just be like very presentable, like, you know, don't hate us, we look like you. And I just didn't think that was as interesting of a protest.
That also sounds familiar, but I'm not sure. I don't remember what one that is.
Yeah. So this one is the Black Cat protests in Los Angeles, February 11th, 1967. Okay, so on New Year's Day, 1967, undercover cops, which always gets me, like, this is what your tax dollars at work in the 60s going in. They raided the Black Cat Tavern in Silver Lake with guns. They were beating patrons with clubs and pool cues. And a bartender was pulled across the bar. Like, his face was, like, lacerated with broken glass. Several drag queens were arrested. And Oz were two men who were engaging in their New Year's Eve kiss. Like, just, that's, you know, heartbreaking. I'm just imagining, like, us being at Club Oasis and, like, I don't know, this going down and, like, Heclina being dragged away. Like, it just is, like, this is, like, this would have been us, Ben Randall, if we were, like, you know, young kids in the 60s. We would have been there.
It would have been. We would have been there.
Been there. So the couple...
At Oasis. At,
yes. The couple was convicted of lewd conduct, and then they had to register as sex offenders. These were the laws that were in place because they were kissing at a club on New Year's Eve. Outrageous. So weeks later, 200 protesters picketed for days in front of the tavern, marking this the first time LGBT people had organized against police harassment. So this is the first time, like, they were like, we are specifically protesting our treatment against the police. A lot of groups be doing this. There's probably something wrong with our police. So they were met by squadrons of armed officers, but they continued their peaceful protests. And then the Black Cat raid and subsequent demonstrations inspired by Richard Mitch and Bill Rao to turn a local gay rights newsletter. They wrote to a local gay rights newsletter in Los Angeles called The Advocate, which soon became The Advocate. The nation's first LGBT news magazine. And then in 2008, the Black Cat was designated as the first Los Angeles Historic Cultural Monument landmark for its significant role in LGBT history. And then on February 11, 2017, activists reenacted the picket outside Black Cat to commemorate the demonstration of the 50th anniversary. Interesting. I'm not a huge reenactment type person. I'd rather just do a theater show. I don't want to do cosplaying of a traumatic event unless there's, like, an audience and they're paying tickets or something. I don't know. I'm not big on reenactments. I don't want to do a Civil War one. I do want to point out is that this, reading all of this, and you hear the volatile relationship between the police and the queer community, I do understand why, and especially given everything that we're talking about with the reckoning with the police, of why, you know, in New York, they've asked police officers cannot march in their uniforms. And there's some folks who are very in the community who are very upset by this. But when you look at our history and also just what's going on right now, and they're not saying that police can't march. They're saying that they don't want them marching in their uniforms. Do you have any thoughts about this in New York City?
It gets complicated because it feels like the relationship with NYPD right now is so fraught that, especially since there's not an official pride parade, that these would be like queer liberation marches.
Oh, I marched and such, in the these last would
be
one. Like,
yeah, these would be one of those much more political ones. So I feel like it feels like it's probably wise. But yeah,
it's not the one sponsored by Chase and Facebook.
Yeah, I don't know if that's happening this year. Is it happening this year? I don't think so. Yeah. It'd be like 2 weeks from now, and I don't think I've heard anything about it. But maybe I'm just... I still have pandemic brain. I don't know.
Yeah, I get it. I understand. I think that's the same. Like, I understand. I understand the conversation of, like, no, we want them to march because we want to build that bridge and that solidarity. I think, given everything that's going on right now in this climate and also our history, I think it's okay to say, hey, for right now, y'all need to figure out your shit, and then you can come put your uniforms back on when y'all figure out what's going on over there.
Accountability before solidarity.
Yes, before you're going to come marching in this protest parade. Do you hear what you did to our drag queens and their faces? Like, there's accountability that needs to happen. Okay, last one, Swan Song. It's the Patch Riot of Los Angeles, August 17th, 1968. So in 1964, Life magazine reported that the LAPD was on a anti-homosexual drive to stop gays from creating what it described as a fruit world. Did you know that, Ben? They were trying to create a fruit world. Why is, like, Gain is associated with like fruit. I never understood that one. Like they're like, oh, he's fruity. Did you ever hear that?
I'm not sure what the etymology is of that. That's true.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I actually remember recently I wore a shirt. One of my favorite shirts has like a bowl of like of cereal and it's like a lot of Fruit Loops in the back. Yeah. And I love that shirt. And it's like a black shirt. And it's probably Urban Outfitters or something. I don't know, but I like it. And I wore that. And my mom was like, oh, why are you wearing that shirt? I was like, oh, I love this shirt. And she was like, is that because you're a fruit?
Wait.
And I actually went.
Mother Randall said correct. This? No.
Correct. And I went, no, I just love cereal.
I love it because in some ways it's sort of like a very like pee. Like, it's like almost like a very pee flaggy mom thing to say. Like maybe like almost.
Yeah, but it actually was a little one of those moments of like, I actually had one of those moments of, you can't say that.
And then,
I was like,
that's not for you.
You're not in the in group.
In fact, you're in an that could be hurtful as my mother for you to say that to me.
Yes. So I took it in stride, but I was a bit like, no.
Yes.
That's not, I think I said just, I was like, no, I like cereal.
Is it because you're a fruit, sweetie? No. Oh, gosh.
I need to try, to be cute. Yeah. Anyway, go on. Okay. Back to Fruit World.
Well, we're trying Fruit World. We're going to create a Fruit World. So LAPD Inspector James Fiss had warned that the pervert is no longer as secretive as he was. He's aggressive, and his aggressiveness is getting worse. Sounds like he had a bad date.
I was gonna say, I'm right here.
Oh man, just gotta use that safe word, baby. All right. So police repeatedly told Lee Glaze, who was the owner of Long Beach's The Patch, that to stay open he had to ban drag acts, physical contact, and male dancing. So like, what is the point? Like what
is the point?
No thank you. Just look at each other. Actually, everyone has to like face the wall. Don't look at anybody.
Exactly. No looking.
Hey. God, what a terrible job that these cops, like, this is not a good life for y'all. But after business took a hit, Glaze was like, no. And so, I love this so much. So he instituted a new protocol that to warn customers when undercover officers were in the bar, he would play God Save the Queen on the jukebox. Look at us. Crafty. I love it so much. And so then on, now I want to like go to I feel like every Pride that song should be played like a, like, you know, house version. So on August 17th, 1968, the Vice Squad arrived demanding IDs and making, you know, bullshit arrests. And then Glaze, fed up, jumped on stage and yelled, it's not against the law to be homosexual and it's not a crime to be in a gay bar. And then he led customers in protest chants and told them that he'd cover their legal costs if they got arrested. And so then two men were detained for lewd conduct, quote unquote. They were probably just kissing. But unlike the other clashes between gay bar goers and the police, the Patch remained open that night. And then the band resumed playing and like 250 people kept on dancing. So they're like, I guess two people got arrested. People were like, oh, it's crazy. Oh, well. Dun, 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 funky town.
So anyway, what are you doing Friday?
I will survive. Oh, gays, we're so interesting. So for the first time in memory, a gay bar not only survived the aftermath of a police raid that had failed so many times before, but then actually thrived. And thanks to the bar manager, you know, taking on the police on their home turf, you know, people were like, oh yeah, this is our place. And this was another very important thing because instead of fleeing and never returning, customers stood by. They were, because a lot of times usually people would be like, oh, I don't want to go there again. Like, I don't want to get my, you know, name in the papers. And there's something I think because the owner, there was such a community that was there and he stood up for his people and the people stood up for them as well. And so people started coming back in droves that this was like a safe place. You're going to be fine. You know, the bar owner's got your back. And Glaze found out where his customers were being held. Oh, it gets even better. Where's this movie? So he found out that his customers were being held in a crowd of about 25. They all went down to the station, giving each other a flower from the flower florist shop that they brought along the way. And they became the Flower Power Rally, took over the Harbor Division police station's waiting room at 3 a.m., prompting the desk officers to call in reinforcement. And then one of the duty officers said, "One flower hits me and you're going to be charged with assault on a police officer." That was his big, you know, big thing. And then eventually the bondsman posted bail, but the police held the two men for several more hours before ultimately dropping the charges and releasing them at dawn. And so I just really loved that story. I think it was just such like a really great one to sort of end on. I love the secret coded like gay messages. It's very like speakeasy gay underground railroad or something. Like, I don't even know what happens. Like, they play like God Save the Queen, and then what do the gays start doing? Just like, well, hello there, fine sir.
Well, I know in the Black Cat in San Francisco, they would in the 50s, you'd immediately run and find a partner of the opposite sex.
Okay.
To start dancing with.
All right. Mm-hmm. I just think like I can't help it. It's so wild, and I like to give thanks. I think like every pride, I like to dive deeper into our history, because we stand on the shoulders of so many, even just to be on this podcast, Ben Randall, you and I. And with no fear of, you know, repercussions from the government or anything, can just have this gay ass conversation. And even like at my job, like I gave a 10-minute presentation on Pride, and that is remarkable. I can even think about, as you know, a 36-year-old going on 36 in a couple of weeks here. I'm just gonna say 36. I love it. I'm here. But like, you know, 12 years ago at a job, you know, I was maybe the only gay Black guy, or maybe there was one other guy, but it was just him and I. We certainly didn't have like an affinity group at work, and then given 10 minutes at a work presentation, on top of that, booking Pride events for the whole entire company to attend. And so I just think like, I don't want to take for granted how far, yes, there's so much more to still go, but I also just really, you know, appreciative of not having to live my life necessarily in the shadows, and very grateful, because I know there's people even in this country who can't be their full selves, and certainly around the world, which is why it's even that much more important for us to like live our truths and say our voice as loud as we can, so it can be a beacon to other folks and keep spreading that gay ass rainbow light.
Well said, gay men. Amen. It should just be gay men.
In 2021, it's finally okay to talk about our mental health, and that's why we're excited to be sponsored by BetterHelp. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions. They'll match you with a therapist in under 48 hours, and it's easy to change therapists if needed. Remember, you don't need a traumatic event to benefit from therapy. Maybe you're feeling anxious or depressed, or stress feels like it's just too much to manage. I mean, come on, look at this past year, of course. So you can then go get some tools to cope and just make life a little bit easier. Y'all know I am such a fan of therapy, as I've said it. Get into therapy now before it's too late. We all have things and traumas and issues that we need to deal with, stresses, anxieties, and you don't have to go it alone. Really, therapy should be mandatory for everybody. It is so great to have that coach, that guide, that person that you can lean on every day with no judgment. Their job is, they've heard it all. So definitely get yourself some BetterHelp today. Plus, BetterHelp, it's way more affordable than in-person therapy, but just as effective. So see if it's for you. It's really great. Again, still up in this pandemic, so really great that you can get your help from the comfort of your own home. So this podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Minority Corner listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/minority. Once again, that's betterhelp.com/minority.
Hi, everybody. My name is Justin McElroy.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
We're both doctors and...
Nope, just me.
Okay, well, Sydney's a doctor and I'm a medical enthusiast, and we create Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine.
Every week, I dig through the annals of medical history to bring you the wildest, grossest, sometimes dumbest tales of ways we've tried to treat people throughout history.
And lately, we do a lot of modern fake medicine, because everything's a disaster, but it's slightly less of a disaster every Friday. right here on MaximumFun.org as we bring you Sawbones, a marital tour of misguided medicine. And remember,
don't drill a hole in your head.
All right, well, that is going to do it. Oh, except I do want to read, false exit, our tweet of the week. It comes from at INOneDraw. At Minority Corner, thank you for recording a podcast for us who didn't catch the live one. Heart, it would have been totally understandable not to, but I saved the episode for the last leg of moving, and it totally made my morning. Thank you. Moving is stressful, painful, and involves way too much driving, and you kept me laughing and learning instead of tearing my hair out. Happy to do so. INOneDraw responding next to both this last week for when we our live episode was lost to the Vimeo goddesses and gods, and last minute we decided to tag Maury and record a last minute episode to make sure we had your content, because we just knew our corner kids were needing us. You know what? That's what we're here for. We got you. We got you. All right. Well, that's going to do it. Big thank you to our production coordinator, Lori Fowler, and our amazing editor, Sarah Brown, making the magic happen. And to all of our Maximum Fun members and to all of our wonderful Minority Corner listeners, we can't do the show without you. We appreciate you. We love you so much. And thank you for listening to Minority Corner, because together we're the majority.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.